America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day, the Republican president stepped up on the platform behind the lectern and said, no man should receive a dollar unless that dollar has been fairly earned. Every dollar received should represent a dollar's worth of service rendered, not gambling in stocks, but service rendered. The really big fortune, the swollen fortune, by the mere fact of its size, acquires qualities which differentiate it in kind as well as in degree from what is possessed by men of relatively small or modest means. Therefore, I believe in a graduated income tax on big fortunes and in another tax which is far more easily collected and far more effective, a graduated inheritance tax on big fortunes properly safeguarded against evasion and increasingly rapidly in amount with the size of the estate. The Republican President Theodore Roosevelt. Which brings us to today's discussion. Michael Schuyler is with us. He's a senior economist for the research research on the economics of taxation with the National Center for Policy Analysis, a conservative think tank, ncpa.org, their website, if you'd like to check it out and learn more about what they're doing and read Michael's work. Michael Schuyler, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you. You have written the Democrats, some Democrats, I'm not sure actually who proposed this. Was this Charlie Rangel or this 4% surcharge?
Yeah, that's Charlie Rangel. Yeah. It was originally suggested by economists at the Tax Policy Center, which is a joint undertaking of Urban Institute and Brookings Institution.
Okay, so here we have Charlie Rangel, and I don't know what, as far as I can tell, he doesn't have much support for this in Congress, but, you know, time will tell, saying let's repeal the alternative minimum tax, which was originally supposed to be the tax that hits people of, you know, who are in the top 2%, but not the top one-tenth of 1%. I mean, $200,000 was, or $100,000 for that matter, back 30 years ago was an enormous amount of money. Today it's not. And, I mean, it is to some people, but it's in the grand scheme of how you define the middle class and all that, it's not. And so he said, let's do away with this alternative minimum tax that's now hitting two-income families really hard and replace it with a simple 4% surtax on the adjusted gross income of people who earn, singles who earn over $100,000, couples who earn over $200,000, and I'm assuming index it to inflation, which the alternative minimum tax should have happened in the first place and didn't happen. You think that's a bad idea? Why?
Well, first, unfortunately, the whole thing is really complicated. Let me try to sort of simplify it a little bit. The alternative minimum tax got its start in 1969 at the very end of the Lyndon Johnson administration when his Treasury Secretary went before Congress and said, you know, a few years ago there were 155 high-income taxpayers and they obeyed all the laws, but they didn't pay any income tax. And that fed into the view that there were lots of problems with the income tax back in the 1960s. Congress very quickly passed minimum taxes that have metamorphosized into the alternative minimum tax.
Right.
And by the way, if the so-called AMT had been indexed for inflation, what was called high income back in 69, 200,000, would be about 1.1 million in today's dollars.
Right, which would actually, in my opinion, make sense. I don't know how what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are you have to look at why those people were not paying tax. For example, one of the problems with the alternative minimum tax is it supposedly went after super rich tax dodgers, but today there are more high-income people who, obeying the law, don't pay tax than back then. But you can look at the reasons for it. We have data most recently from 2004. Turns out, biggest thing, tax-exempt municipal bond interest,
right?
Which to some degree helps the taxpayers, but most of the benefit actually goes to states and localities.
Right, and in fact, this is one of the big investments of the Bush family. This is when George Bush was born, the millions of dollars that he was born with, his trust fund was in tax-exempt bonds.
I don't know, but
they accumulate rather rapidly. Well, that's the lore, anyway. That's my understanding.
Yeah, well, that could be.
And
and by the way, there are a few other things. Also,
sure.
For example, huge medical expenses can mean you have a high income, but you don't owe income tax.
Assuming you have no insurance.
Yeah. Absolutely. Again,
which is pretty rare for high-income people. But here's the larger question, Michael Skyler,
sure.
NCPA.org. From the mid-1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt raised the income tax on people making over, in today's dollars, $3.2 million a year, up to 91%. From that time until... was it 62 or 63, when Kennedy dropped that down to 71%, but in the process overtly called it, in fact, proclaimed in the 1960s debates with Nixon that it would be a tax increase on the wealthy, because he said he was in that tax bracket and nobody he knew was paying the 91%. Everybody had figured out ways around it. Most people were paying 40-50%. So he closed loopholes and dropped it down to 71%, actually increased taxes on wealthy people. And it was at 71% until Reagan came along in 1981, 82, and he dropped it down to 27%, just crashed it. And the consequence of that, ever since then, I mean, for that period of time when we had that very progressive taxation, the kind that actually Adam Smith called for in The Wealth of Nations, I can give you the quote, we had a strong middle class, and we had very few dynastic empires emerging. In other words, it wasn't the landed gentry that historically has been associated with laissez-faire economics like you see in England. And since Reagan basically undid that chunk of the New Deal, and we've had these relatively low tax rates, even for the super rich, we're seeing the super rich exploding, and we've seen the middle class collapse. Why not go back? Why not roll back Reagan's tax cut? Why not go back to the 71% tax rate and close the loopholes? And as Teddy Roosevelt pointed out, you know, if somebody has great wealth, they have great obligations to society. In fact, they're using more of society's infrastructure than the average person.
Well,
let them pay for it.
I'll tell you, Tom, I agree with you about the Kennedy tax cuts. And Kennedy did have an important insight. Namely, you had these super high marginal rates, but because of those high rates, there were a lot of loopholes, some unjustified, but some of them needed to prevent disaster with such high rates. And you had the Kennedy cuts, the average tax rates actually went up, even though the marginal went down.
Right.
Interesting thing is you had the same thing under Reagan. For example, looking at 1981 versus 2005, it's true the average tax rate on the top 1% went down by about a third, but the average tax rate on the bottom 50% went down about 50%. So,
well, the bottom 50% is not making a lot of money. I mean,
no, the
bottom 50% would be making less than $47,000 a year, if my recollection is correct.
Yeah, but I'm talking about average income tax rate. So
dropping the taxes on people making less than $47,000. Frankly, I think somebody making $47,000 a year should be paying no income tax. Because that's a baseline for basically survival for a family anyway. I mean, you know, if we're going to have a middle class in the United States, that's just not an enormous amount of money. What I'm trying to tease out of this is I'm assuming that you are opposed to progressive taxation. Am I wrong in that assumption?
Well, I'm probably opposed to quite as much progressivity in the tax code as you are. That would be my guess. The problem is when you get very steep marginal tax rates, you tend to have a lot of distortions in people's behavior, less work, less saving.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that somebody who is, if it hits 91% at $3.2 million, that somebody who is right now earning, say, $30 or $40 million a year as a Wall Street banker wouldn't work just as hard for $3 million? I think they would.
What about small business people, doctors, lawyers? Would they work as hard, or would they maybe decide not to work those extra hours Saturday? or if you're a doctor, not to see an extra patient.
Do you think the average doctor makes over $3.2 million? I don't.
No, I don't either. But I'm thinking.
So this, you know, this didn't hit those people.
Tax rates.
Well, not really. I mean, the before Reagan crashed the tax rate, I mean, it wasn't hitting those folks. And so, anyway, it's an interesting conversation. We should continue it another time. But thanks for your insights, Michael. Michael Schuyler, he's the senior economist for the research on the economics of taxation with the National Center for Policy Analysis. Their website, ncpa.org. You can check
thank
it out.
You, Tom.
Michael, thank you for dropping by.
Bye-bye.
16 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Going hungry with no shoes on their feet. While the government just twiddles its thumbs and spends more money on guns. And they keep on planning
I don't think so, and I think increasingly Americans are saying, nah, don't think so. Reagan came along, we had an economy that was working quite well, thank you very much. We had a middle class that was very strong. But the cons were looking at this thing in 1981, they were looking at the economy of the United States, they were looking at the fact that 25% of the entire workforce was unionized, meaning half of all Americans had a job, because for every union job, there's another job in the private sector without a union associated with it that has equal pay and benefits because the union jobs establish the local floors for employment. So we had half, 25% of unionization, half the entire workforce of the United States had a job where they had, you know, the equivalent of a good solid union job. In other words, they had full health care, they had a pension they could retire on, they had enough income that they could buy a house and a car and they could put their kids through school, they could take a vacation for a couple weeks every year. Half of our workforce. Now, it had been 70% of our workforce 10 years earlier. The Taft-Hartley bill that the Republicans pushed through Congress in 1947 had cut unionization from 35% down to 25% of the private workforce. But Reagan, you know, this was intolerable to the cons that brought Reagan into power in 1980, in the election of 1980. It was absolutely intolerable. We can, you know, what, having the people? And that kind of problem. And the biggest problem for the cons was that the elites, the most wealthy and powerful in America, were not aggregating massive amounts of wealth at very, very rapid rates as they had during the period from the 1870s after the Civil War until the Republican Great Depression of 1929. And they wanted back. They wanted to go back to that time. And we had been in the New Deal era ever since the 1930s, and Reagan came in, and his job was to dismantle the New Deal. And he started out by taking the top marginal tax rate and saying, if you're making, you know, it used to be if you made over $3.2 million a year, then you started paying a 71% tax rate. And what that did is it produced a certain amount of leveling. Corporations, by and large, paid their CEOs in the neighborhood of $3 million a year at the top end, which was a lot of money. I mean, still is. And so you had, on average, when Reagan came into office, the average CEO in the United States made about 30 to 40, in some cases as much as 50 times what the lowest paid janitor in the company made. Reagan does away with this income tax, this progressive income tax, and now the top CEOs are making 500, 600, 800, 1,000 times, in some cases as much as 10,000 times what the lowest paid person in the company is making. There's really no cap on it anymore. In fact, if you take your pay like William McGuire did with the United Healthcare, $1.6 billion in compensation over 10 years, if you take your pay in the form of stock options that you can then redeem and sell off, it's long-term capital gains, and you pay a maximum income tax rate, get this, not of, you know, 33, 34% like working people do today. No, you pay a maximum income rate of 15%. If you're a millionaire or a billionaire and you're living off selling your stock options that you got as being a CEO. This is what Reagan brought us, and well, the 15% is what George Bush brought us. This is from his last tax cut 2 years ago. But when he crashed the top marginal rate from 70% down to 27%, corporate taxes also went down. They were 33% of total federal tax receipts, a third of all tax receipts, when Eisenhower came into office. And they're less than 9% now. The result was devastating. Reagan, in order to keep the government from going bankrupt for all practical purposes, I mean, the red ink was flowing so badly as a consequence of his income tax cuts that he had to double the taxes on everybody who made less than $40,000 a year by doubling the Social Security tax and then borrowing that money into the general fund so that he could cover the loss of the revenue from the income tax. And it's been that way ever since. They've been borrowing ever since then. I just find it amazing that the Democrats are timidly, frankly, and Rangel is being attacked for being too bold. Here's Charlie Rangel. He's saying, hey, let's put a 4% tax on people of great wealth, people making over $200,000 a year. That's not great wealth, but it's a starting point. And do away with the alternative minimum tax that is whacking people of middle wealth. And it's like, oh, my God, he's talking about 4%. I think we should roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Let's bring back the middle class. I find it impossible to believe. Now, maybe you can convince me. 866-303-2270. Maybe you can convince me. But I find it impossible to believe that a Wall Street banker or a CEO making $30 or $40 or $50 million a year, or somebody like William McGuire making $1 billion, wouldn't work just as many hours and just as hard for $3 million. I don't believe it. I believe that they would. They'd say, hey, $3 million, I'll do that for $3 million. And then the 20% increment above that. But yeah, $3 million, yeah, I'd do that. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Simple-minded and the uninformed can be easily led astray. And those that cannot connect the dots, hey, look the other way. People believe what they want to believe when it makes no sense at all. And I wish you all along sidelines and the strength to walk on. Walk tall. Yeah, walk on.
34 minutes past the hour. Here's the idea behind progressive taxation. It's a very, very simple concept. It was first laid out in the modern era by Adam Smith, a British economist in 1776 who wrote a book called Wealth of Nations that continues to inform economics. It's probably the seminal book on economics that's ever been written. And this is Adam Smith. I'm quoting directly from the Wealth of Nations. Keep in mind, this was written in 1776, so this is written in a language that's a little more flowery and a little less direct than we might say today. But it's nonetheless pretty clear. Adam's, and it's only five or six sentences here. Adam Smith, 1776, Wealth of Nations. The necessaries of life occasion the great expense of the poor. In other words, the poor spend most of their money on what's necessary to live. Back to Adam Smith. They find it difficult to get food, and the greater part of their little revenue is spent in getting it. The luxuries and vanities of life occasion the principal expense of the rich. And a magnificent house embellishes and sets off to the best advantage all the other luxuries and vanities which they possess. A tax, therefore, would in general fall heaviest upon the rich. And in this sort of inequality, and he acknowledges, taxing the rich more heavily than the poor is inequality. And in this sort of inequality, there would not perhaps be anything very unreasonable. It is not very unreasonable that the rich should contribute to the public expense, not only in proportion to their revenue, but something more than in that proportion. Adam Smith, 1776, calling for progressive income tax. The other guy in the 1770s who was arguing very strongly for a progressive tax based on income or based on net wealth was Thomas Paine, his book, The Rights of Man. Jonathan in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Jonathan, it says you want to disagree with me. You go to the front of the line. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Well, and I wanted to say first that I'm a fan of yours. I've read many of your books, Screwed, We the People, Last Average, Ancient Sunlight. I'm for middle class. I'm for Kucinich. I'm for higher minimum wages. I'm for progressive taxes. However, you had mentioned a few minutes ago that you didn't believe there should be taxes for people below, like, $40,000 a year, their income.
I wouldn't oppose setting that as the floor, because if we're operating on the assumption that a person who really has not enough left over to save and not enough left over to have luxuries of life, if we're talking about a family of four, $40,000 a year in probably most of America, certainly in much of America, is really just barely getting by, particularly when you consider health care costs. Now, if we had free national health insurance and if Social Security became strengthened back to the way it was during the 50s, where it actually was a pension that you could survive on in old age, then I'd probably recalibrate that down to maybe $25,000 or $30,000 a year. But
okay.
That's my premise. I mean, you want to disagree with that?
Sure. Well, and I mean, that sounds very reasonable. I just wanted to say I'm 28. I have a master's degree, and I've never earned more than $30,000 a year so far.
Do you have health insurance?
What's that? No, I don't.
Well,
I'm currently unemployed. I'm in between jobs. I just
yeah.
get an intern.
But I mean, you know, if you're earning $30,000 a year and health insurance is going to cost you $10,000, if you want to have that $30,000 lifestyle with health insurance, you're going to have to earn $40,000.
Sure. But I did want to say that, I mean, me personally, I don't want to be a freeloader on society. I'd like to, you know, pay my share. And I feel like if you don't pay taxes, at least, you know, a small percent, you know, like let's say once you earn $20,000, you start paying 10% on top of that or whatever. I think it's kind of destructive to your self-worth.
I don't disagree, but if you're making $40,000 a year and you're paying no income tax, you're still paying 8% or 9% FICA, whatever it is these days. You're paying into the Social Security fund. You're paying into Medicare. You're paying sales tax every time you buy something in most states. You're paying property tax on the land that you own, if not directly through being a homeowner, indirectly through the cost of your rents. I mean, there are all kinds of taxes built into our system that every time you buy gasoline, you're paying taxes. We are paying taxes. But, you know, your point of, okay, everybody should pay even some small amount of income tax in order to feel like they're a stakeholder in the society, I think you're right. You know, I'd go along with that. So let me recalibrate what I'm suggesting then and say that, you know, at the low end, we need a more steeply progressive income tax and, you know, rolling back the Reagan tax cuts and indexing it to inflation so at the low end people are paying, you know, 2, 3, 5, 8%, something like that, so that they feel like they're stakeholders in society, they feel like they're participating in society, and yet the tax is not making it hard for them to survive. I mean, the necessaries of life, as Adam Smith refers to, are still available to them.
Definitely.
Okay. All righty, great. Thanks a lot, Jonathan. For a minute there, I thought I had a right-wing crank. Disagree. Anyway, Woody in Litchfield Park, Arizona. Hey, Woody, what's up?
Oh, not much. Just wanted to weigh in on the differences between income and wages.
Yeah.
I'm a federal employee, and I get my W-2 at the end of the year. And it shows that when I now I'm eligible for Medicare, that's the way they phrased it when we became subject to the tax, my wages are higher than what my income is because I participate in a 401k in the government. It's called TSP. And it just makes it so glaringly obvious that, well, true income, the interest I earn off my investments, is at that point deferred, and yet my wages are taxed, and Social Security and Medicare are clearly wage taxes and not income taxes.
You're absolutely right, and the point is that you're being taxed on money that you don't even receive because it's being shuttled off to the 401ks and things like that. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, actually, mine isn't taxed. It's a deferred tax until I hit retirement, and then I can pull it out.
On the 401k.
Then it'll be taxed. But the point is that most of the people in the income categories that you're talking about do not have income. They have wages.
Oh,
and I think that's been a big confusion and detriment to our country.
Well, and in fact, we flipped this thing upside down on its head. If you're defining wages as the work that you get from the sweat of your brow or this, you know, from your mind or from your body, in other words,
right.
you know, working, that's wages. And income is what you get from investment.
Yes.
And I think that we're in agreement. We could build a very, very strong case for saying, let's tax income, let's not tax wages. And what Bush has done is flip that upside down. Right now, wages are taxed at 34, 35%, whatever the top marginal tax rate is, and income if that is dividends and capital gains, are taxed at a maximum of 15%. And by the way, that's indexed. That is a progressive tax. So, you know, if you make a small amount of income in from dividends and interest, you pay less than 15% taxes. I mean, it's bizarre. It's like we dropped through a rabbit hole, and it all started with Reagan. And, okay, Woody, thanks a lot. Good point.
Yeah, real quick, that's what Warren Buffett was talking about, because his income is all income, and his employees are wages.
But exactly. That's the point he made when he said that his secretary pays twice as much in taxes as he does on, you know, on a percentage basis. And it's true. Bob in Seattle. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to ask you this question here. I'm curious. It's kind of which came first, the chicken, hawk, or the egg?
Uh-huh.
And that is that over the last 30 years, this Milton Friedman, kind of what Paul Krugman called the great unraveling of the New Deal, this free market, free trade type economic model that we've lived under here, do you think that this type of model sets the stage for the environment with an anxious, kind of insecure population, that we therefore get political leadership like George Bush? In other words, the economic model, as Mr. Greenspan stated, part of the duties of the Federal Reserve was to keep the workforce kind of anxious.
Insecure was the word he used.
Insecure. Keep them on their toes. If you have a more well-balanced, undistorted type of an economy similar to what you have in, say, Sweden or Western European nations, don't you have a population that's more secure, more well-balanced, that will demand leadership? In other words, if...
Yes.
So, in other words, that's the real danger of this economic model.
Well, it's the real danger from the point of view of you and me. It's the real benefit from the point of view of the conservatives, who don't believe in small D democracy, who believe in a rule by a meritocracy. They believe that you can't trust the people, the rabble, as John Adams referred to us, and that instead we should have the most meritorious among us, to borrow a phrase from Alexander Hamilton, the most meritorious among us rise to the levels of leadership in the country and lead the. In fact, that was his argument for why the president should be elected for life when he gave his initial speech at the Constitutional Convention.
Tom, that's certainly not what we have with George W. Bush. But
see, the way that they know that somebody is meritorious is the old Calvinist notion that, you know, wealth is proof of God's blessing. And so if somebody is a CEO making enormous amounts of money, or they're born into a very wealthy family, they must be meritorious. So in the conservative worldview, Bush actually is meritorious in that Calvinistic worldview.
So, but what I guess what I'm saying is that if George W. Bush were never born, this current free market model that we're living under, we would have someone similar to Bush in office.
I agree. Absolutely. Not necessarily quite as crazy with regard to a war and killing people. But you'd have somebody, I mean, today, this is just amazing. Today, George Bush vetoed a $606 billion education and health bill. I mean, it vetoed this thing. This had bipartisan support. Over 50 Republicans were supporting this thing. He vetoes it on Air Force One, you know, no ceremony, no big press conference or anything. Why? Because, hey, it's health and education. I mean, we can't have that, but we sure can't have wars. Thank you, Bob. And this is one of the reasons why the conservatives are so concerned about there being a strong middle class. They don't want there to be a strong middle class, because back in the 1970s and the 1770s, the strong middle class rose up.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
With no kind of chance for the flag or the liberty bell. I wish the Ford and the Chevy would still last 10 years like they should.
All right.
The best of the free life behind us now. The good time's really over for good.
Stop rolling downhill like snow.
You tell them, Willie.
Let's make a Ford and a Chevy that would still last 10 years like the show. Cause the best of the free life is still yet to come. The good times ain't over for good.
No, not so long as there's still a few of us standing, walking, breathing, and talking, I'll tell you. By the way, speaking of walking, talking, and breathing, tonight at 7 o'clock for our listeners in New York and WWRL, and I believe I'm going to be doing the show live from WWRL, in fact, Thursday morning, I will be at the, but tonight at 7 p.m., I'll be at the Strand Bookstore here in Manhattan for at 7 o'clock, signing Cracking the Code, my new book. I'll be doing about a 30, 40, we'll see how long it goes, talk on the topic and question and answer, and then we'll be signing the books. And tomorrow, after we finish the show, I'll be at Demos here in New York, the Network for Ideas in Action, at 225th Avenue, 5th floor. That's at 5:30 p.m. And you can check out their website for more information. Just Google Demos. On Friday, I will be in San Francisco, and we'll be doing the show live Friday morning, what will be morning in San Francisco time, from Green 960 a.m. And Friday afternoon, November 16th, I'll be at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City from 3:30 until 6. For more information, go to green960.com. And on Saturday, we'll be doing two book signings back-to-back. One is already sold out, so they've opened another one in Carmel, California, with KRXA at the Pilgrim's Way Bookstore. And then at the end of the month, I'll be in Los Angeles on November 29th at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble on the 3rd Street Promenade. So a lot coming up. We're having a lot of fun. One of our callers mentioned Sweden. Yesterday in the Financial Times, the Monday interview was with Jacob Wallenberg. The Wallenbergs are like the Rothschilds or the Rockefellers. I mean, the Wallenberg family arguably controls, a company called Investor, which has a net worth equal to about a third of the total of all of Sweden's stock market. I mean, they own major corporations, so just huge, huge companies that most people would recognize, Electrolux, Ericsson, you know, the cell phone company and whatnot, Scania, Saab, ABB, AstraZeneca, the drug company. What's amazing, though, this company started 150 years ago in 1858 by Andre Wallenberg, the great-great-grandfather of Jacob Wallenberg, the guy who was interviewed yesterday. And he started it as a bank, and then there was a depression in 1919, 1916, in the late 1880s. There was a depression in Sweden, as there was in much of the world, as the robber barons were taking over. And the people that they had loaned money to couldn't pay them back, the businesses, and so they took stock in the companies in exchange for that so that the companies didn't go out of business. And the Wallenberg family ended up owning this bank that owned about a third of the Swedish businesses. Well, in 1916, the Swedish Parliament made it illegal for a bank to own businesses. So what the family did is they took all of the stock and they put it in a non-profit corporation called Investor. And you can buy stock in this non-profit corporation, but the family no longer owns it. I mean, the Knut Wallenberg, the founder's son, he had no children. And so he and his wife, Alice, put everything into this nonprofit corporation. Now, he had brothers and sisters, and they had children. And so here we are now at the fifth generation of Wallenbergs. That's Jacob Wallenberg. He's running the thing now. His total income, $1.9 million a year. That's how much he makes. And, Financial Times says, why should somebody invest in Investor? This is a company that buys companies and then sits on their boards and encourages them to behave in socially responsible ways. Why should we invest with you? And Jacob Wallenberg answers. He says, as far as I can tell, I haven't seen anybody demand that you have to invest in Investor. Have you? No. So if you don't like our business model, it's very easy to vote with your feet, invest in something else. But I think the important thing is if you look at the returns that we've generated over these 90 years, we outperform most comparable entities reasonably well. In other words, the Swedes are saying, hey, this is fine with us. And they say, well, why do you do this, in this nonprofit? Well, he says, I think it's a matter of values, family values, pride in the family, understanding the history, and asking yourself, are you proud of this? Is this something you'd like to try to further or not? This is, and this is like, hey, you know, welcome to the new normal in Sweden. Kurt in Portola Valley, California. Hey, Kurt.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Tom. I just wanted to tell you about a regressive tax that has got no publicity with all the talk about the alternative minimum tax. It's the tax on Social Security benefits for retirees, which takes effect when they reach a total of $25,000 for their all their other income plus half of their Social Security benefits.
Right. And
it was put into effect in 1984. It has never been indexed. So if you compare a guy in 1984 with one today, the guy in 1984 probably had very little Social Security payment, and most of his $25,000 was made up of his income.
Yeah. And that,
today,
and that, yeah.
The Social Security has grown as a result of it being pumped up every year.
Right, as a result
his
of inflation.
His other income has gone down because yep. the total is only $25,000.
So no, you're absolutely right, Kurt. Another gift to us from Ronald Reagan and it's just and the conservatives. It's like, it's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Forget the Bush tax cuts. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, two broad areas today that I'd like to, in this hour, get into. One has to do with what's going on with the economy. I mean, this is wild. It's absolutely the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, is asking banks to be more transparent about their exposure to U.S. subprime loans. I mean, the IMF. This isn't like, you know, the Fed. This isn't like a U.S. regulatory agency. This isn't like some state government. This is the International Monetary Fund. This is the lead story from today's Financial Times. Not the lead story in the Financial Times, but the lead paragraph from the story. The headline, IMF urges subprime transparency. It's on page 4. European banks should be required to disclose their exposure to the U.S. subprime market, the International Monetary Fund said yesterday. Now, in another story, Eurozone finance ministers impatient with the euro's unceasing rise against the dollar, the renminbi, and the yen spoke out yesterday against excessive exchange rate volatility and urged China to play its part in rebalancing the world's economy. Yeah, right. Like, they're going to do that. I can just, you know, see it happening tomorrow morning. On the front page of today's Financial Times, the U.S. mortgage crisis is deeper and scarier than anyone expected, Tony James, president of Blackstone, said yesterday as shares of the U.S. private equity group fell on news that its revenues had fallen sharply below expectations in the third quarter. Again, this whole subprime thing. And what is the whole subprime thing all about? The whole subprime thing is all about, and again, we get back to, in a way, what we were talking about in the last hour. In the last hour, we were talking about how a strongly progressive income tax acts as a rudder, essentially, a gentle brake on wild excesses in private wealth. And the requirement of corporations to kowtow to those wild excesses. Now, similarly here with the subprime thing, we've got wild excesses. I mean, you know, just people out there hustling. Hey, got no credit? Got no money? Got no income? No problem. We'll loan you some money. Why? Because we can repackage that loan and sell it in Europe. Which now is why the IMF is saying, we'd like to know, the banks in Europe, how many of these loans are they sitting on? We're even finding, I mean, this is kind of spooky. We're even finding that E-Trade, this electronic, you know, online trading company, their shares, this is the front page from the Companies and Markets section of the Financial Times, top story, screaming headline across the top, E-Trade shares plummet 59%. They're using the B word, bankruptcy. You know, is it possible that this company could become bankrupt? Or will it? Will they get a cash infusion? Their stock is actually right now trading below what the company is capitalized at, what the company theoretically is worth at liquidation. So everybody's expecting, I think, that somebody's going to, you know, some big bank in all probability is going to come in and buy them because their stock is so cheap right now. But broadly speaking, and there's a great article by Liz Moyer about this in Forbes, Forbes.com on their website. Broadly speaking, she says, worries about the state of the banking system are mounting. Bank failures are becoming more of a worry as well. So far this year, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp reported 3 failures, 2 in the last 2 months. Now, that's out of 8,000 banks. It's not a huge big deal. I mean, keep in mind, there were almost 1,000 SNLs that went belly up back in the SNL crisis of 1988 and 89. Which was, let's see, during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, was it not, as I recall? Bailing out his son with the Silverado savings and loan. So anyhow, there's that. And, there, you know, again, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, the role of government in this had what you're seeing right now, what we're seeing right now. Here's the bottom line. Let me just boil it all down. What we're seeing right now with companies freaking out, E-Trade going down, Blackstone going down, the market getting volatile, everybody being, you know, afraid about their savings and in the future. To some extent, oil and gold exploding because the dollar's crashing. What we're seeing is the direct consequence of this absolute religious belief. And I say it as a religious belief because it is, and I say this, I suppose, with some respect, as I consider myself at least a reasonably religious person. But nonetheless, this religious, you know, a religious belief is the faith in something unseen, right? I mean, this religious belief, and I think it's a false religion, this religious belief in this so-called free market. There is no such thing as a free market. There never has been. There never will be. It requires a community. It requires a social consensus to create any kind of marketplace. If you and I were the only two, if we were the only two people in the world, but even then there wouldn't be a free market because we would have to agree on the terms of the marketplace. But let's say that you and I agree to swap. This is about as open and free as a marketplace can get, barter, okay? And I'll wash your car if you mow my lawn. And we agree to that. Now, that seems like a free marketplace deal, doesn't it? But what happens if while I'm washing your car, I accidentally, or perhaps even intentionally, perhaps I'm upset, I don't like the car, smash the windshield? Then what? Well, then there needs to be some rules to this trade that we just executed, this barter agreement that we had. For example, if I damage your property, I'm responsible for it. Well, that rule is in the real world something we call a law. And if I refuse to pay, then you have to take me to a court, which is an institution of government, and the court will decide whether I need to pay you or not. And if I still refuse to pay after the court decides that I have to pay, and they decide that there was some malice, some criminal intent involved, they have the ability to throw me in jail, another institution of government. Or if to flip it around, I said, sure, I'll wash your car if you'll mow my lawn. And I guess I'm making myself the bad guy in both cases here in this example. And after we make the agreement, you've never seen my lawn before, and you discover that my lawn is 25 acres. I mean, it isn't, but I don't even have a lawn. But what if you discovered that it was? You say, hey, wait a minute. My car is this little VW Beetle and that you're going to wash, and I've got to mow 25 acres? That's not a fair trade. I went out of the deal, and I say, oh, wait a minute, you made a deal. So am I going to be able to enforce the contract and force you to do it, or are you going to be able to go before a court and say, hey, wait a minute, this, you know, I was deceived. He didn't disclose to me all the... There is no such thing as a free market. There are all these rules that create the marketplace, hundreds of thousands of pages of them, rules and laws that as a society we create to create a market. There is no such thing as a free market. And once you step beyond barter, You know, if I say, okay, I'll give you $10 if you'll mow my lawn, and then you'll give me $10 if I wash your car. Now, it's still a barter, but we're using dollars as a medium of exchange. Now, in addition to the government having court systems and jails and everything to enforce that, we need to have the government maintaining a stable currency, a stable medium of exchange, so that that $10 that you give me, I can actually use for something. Again, it's not a free market. It is a market that has been created and is regulated and controlled by we the people collectively, in a democracy anyway, by we, unlike a dictatorship like you have in China, for example, or the old Soviet Union, which didn't work. But in a democracy, it is you know, the regulation of the marketplace by we the people through our elected representatives. And some people call that socialism. This is what's so bizarre. The front page of today's Wall Street Journal, the screaming headline. I mean, this is the only headline across the top of the front page. Mortgage crisis extends its reach. And there are two stories that then sub out of that headline, with subhead, you know, that run down. And the first by James Haggerty. Ever since the Great Depression, the American home loan business has included a dollop of socialism. Say, what? No, it's not socialism. If you do it, what they did is they said, okay, let's deregulate the banking industry. Let's deregulate the mortgage industry. In other words, let's have less oversight by we the people and more availability of opportunity for predators. That's really what it came down to. Because the oversight was there to protect us from the predators. And the predators came out in some substantial numbers. And they made a lot of money. And they left the rest of us holding the bag. And they're leaving banks all over the world holding the bag. And they may be driving us into at the very least, a recession as a consequence of this. It's not socialism. This is deregulation. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. By the way, tonight at the Strand, when I'm showing up for the book signing, Richard Belzer, brilliant guy, is going to be introducing me. And tomorrow night, Mark Green, the CEO of Air America, will be introducing me at Demos. So that should be great fun. Speaking of government, Dianne Feinstein, there's a growing call for, I'm not sure that there's yet a move in Congress, but there's certainly a growing call for a censure of some sort against Dianne Feinstein. She has a safe seat. I mean, she was reelected in 2006. When she's up for reelection in 2012, I believe she'll be like 80 years old. So I don't think that she's all that concerned about, you know, electoral politics right now. But it was her vote, along with Schumer, that allowed Mukasey to become the Attorney General, even in the face of his unwillingness to acknowledge that waterboarding is torture. But it goes beyond that. I mean, her role in many of these things goes beyond just what happened with Mukasey. Glenn Greenwald wrote a great piece about this over in Salon. And it's really, you know, quite startling. She plays a pivotal role in the Judiciary Committee, which has a 10-9 Democratic majority. If she joins committee Republicans in voting to protect telecommunication companies from lawsuits for their roles in the surveillance program, the proposal, this is a top priority of George Bush, will become part of the legislation that reaches the Senate floor. We will find out day after tomorrow. But it looks like she's going to do that. She seems to be backing immunity. So it's like Dianne Feinstein repeatedly is taking, apparently, the positions of George Bush. In fact, she's even using some of his language. She says the telecom should not be held hostage to costly litigation in what is essentially a complaint about administration activities. That, as Glenn Greenwald points out, is the exact same phrase verbatim that was in Fred Hyatt's editorial 2 weeks ago urging amnesty, and this in a right-wing publication. So, I know this is certainly, you know, this is more an issue, I suppose, for the voters of California, except for the fact that they can't, probably will not have another opportunity to vote on, you know, Dianne Feinstein, but a concern. 1-866-303-2270. What direction is our country going? Where are we going? How are we going to get there? Anna. Is it Anna or Anna in Murfreesboro, Tennessee?
Anna.
Anna, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I want to first thank you for being my in-transit professor between undergrad and grad school.
You're welcome.
Okay, so I want to take you back to the first hour, which I hate to do to you, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Quite right.
Take you a little bit further back than the Reagan administration regarding regressive taxation.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I think in order to understand the U.S. tax scheme, the tax structure, we have to examine the predilections of American social psychology, right? And going back specifically to Tocqueville and Hamilton and Adam mm-hmm. Smith and even more so the social Darwinists of the 1880s. Whose policies eventually led to the Great Depression.
Right. You could go all the way back to the beginning. In my book, What Would Jefferson Do? I quote Thomas Jefferson writing about how a person living at the level of the necessaries of life should not be taxed.
Exactly.
And that was my whole point is, you know, whatever is the level of the necessaries of life or the necessities of life is, you know, as Adam Smith and Thomas Jefferson referred to it,
mm-hmm.
That should be the threshold above which income tax begins and below which there is none.
Right. Exactly. And specifically, what came to my mind just sparked my kind of thought process was thinking about Thorstein Veblen
mm-hmm.
and the theory of the leisure class and how relevant that is today and how these philosophies have just been put into hyperdrive to a certain extent and that we've reached basically the climax of our evolutionary economical structure as Veblen would have proposed.
Well, and he also wasn't he the one who suggested that there is an influencer class in society and
exactly.
and that if that and it's about 20% as they call 18 to 20% of society
right.
and it represents sort of the upper middle class generally economically but not always and if that influencer class can be influenced then the entire society can be turned. That's the rudder that will move the ship.
Right.
And that's why all this money was poured into the conservative think tanks in the 1970s and 1980s mm-hmm. by like the Scaife family and the Coors family and other, you know, very, very wealthy fortunes that were seeking to protect their multi-generational wealth. And then a lot of large multinational corporations got on board to change the minds of the influencers through op-eds and editorials and presentations and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
They've done it. They've done it. And you know, it's amazing. When Bill Clinton, who campaigned as a progressive liberal, but governed as essentially a Reagan Republican, when he said the era of big government is over, I knew that those guys had done their work right. But Anna, your point is well taken. Thank you very much for calling and making it. You got to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. But our job now is to wake Americans back up to what were the values of this country for 200 years.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You see everything. You see every part. You see all my light. And you love my dark. You dig everything. Of which I'm ashamed.
34 minutes past the hours. So here, this whole fabric we're seeing being woven here, it's really quite remarkable. The lead of the Wall Street Journal, Mortgage Crisis Extends Its Reach. James Haggerty writing, ever since the Great Depression, the American home loan business has included a dollop of socialism. And he's talking basically about how nobody wants to buy these repackaged loans any longer, and so the government is having to step in and buy them or guarantee them, basically Freddie and Fannie. In fact, the subhead, Fannie Freddie regain dominance as investors shrink from housing. And then he quotes the CEO of Countrywide, one of the big companies that does subprime mortgages. Says, capitalism isn't perfect, says CEO Angelo Mozzillo of Countrywide, which had a $1.2 billion loss in the third quarter as investors suddenly grew allergic to mortgages that they had eagerly bought before. So you've got that. You've got the ongoing evisceration of the middle class as a consequence of Reagan's cutting taxes, Reagan's union busting. We're now down to about 7% of the private workforce being unionized as opposed to 25% when Reagan came into office. And all of this in the name of fighting socialism. And that battle of fighting socialism is still going on by conservative members of Congress, principally Republicans, but there are some Democrats as well, in fighting the socialism of government-funded health care. For example, the S-CHIP program, which I don't know why the Democrats haven't come up with a name for this. I mean, if the Republicans can name a take away your rights bill, the Patriot Act, why can't the Democrats call this something like the, you know, the Children's Health Initiative or the, you know, Saving Our Children Law or something like that? Come on, Democrats, do a little messaging. But anyhow, they call it S-CHIP, which is meaningless to most Americans, but this is what it is. It's the State Children's Health Insurance Program. And Catholics United, their website, Catholics-United.org, there's a dash in there, which differentiates them from another Catholic, a United Catholic group that's working for poor people, which is Catholics United for the Poor, which is Catholics-United.org. This is Catholics-United.org, a non-profit, non-partisan organization. They describe themselves as dedicated to promoting the message of justice and the common good found at the heart of the Catholic social tradition. It has launched ads against pro-life politicians who are voting against children's health care. Now, this is one that is targeting Congressman Good. This is a hoot. Listen to this.
I'm the mother of three children, and I'm pro-life. I believe that protecting the lives of our children must be our nation's number one moral priority. That's why I'm concerned that Congressman Good says he's pro-life, but for the second time in a month, he's voted against health care for kids. That's not pro-life. That's not pro-family. Tell Virgil Good to vote for kids, not Bush's veto. Call him today at 540-484-1254.
Paid for by Catholics Unite.
Isn't that great? Now, that's that was against Virgil Good of Virginia, the Republican from Virginia. They're running similar ads about Congressman Jim Marshall, the Democrat from Georgia, who's voting against health care for children and calls himself pro-life, against Congressman Todd, I think it's Tiahart, T-I-A-H-R-T, Tiahart, I'm not sure how you say it, the Republican from Kansas, and Kenny Hulsoff, the Republican from Missouri. And it's like calling them on it. It's, and you get it, you start getting it, that there is basically, that built into this, you know, every man for himself attitude built into this whole weird mindset is the idea that, you know, government should play no role in anything unless it's protecting my wealth. Then we want a strong government. Or unless it's making sure that you're not having sex with the wrong person or you're not trying to marry the wrong person or you're, well, there's all these unlesses. Dan in Manhattan. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program. Dan, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good.
Really, really like your show.
Thank you.
Getting back to the progressive tax and the negative effects that high taxes can have, for example, I'll just take the corporate tax here. My company just built a new manufacturing facility in Switzerland, not exactly a country known for low wages. The reason they did was because of the corporate tax rate. So as a result, America and American business loses the manufacturing of the plant, all the workers who will work in there for the next 10, 15 years, all the people who go and visit the factory will have to stay in hotels, taxis. That's a considerable loss.
Dan, I don't believe for a minute that your company made that decision because of the difference in corporate taxes between Sweden or, what did you say, Switzerland?
Switzerland.
Switzerland and the United States.
Tom, they sure did. At our national sales meeting, I'm a salesman for it. It was an offhand remark. It wasn't like, we did this, you know, for a political reason. He mentioned we're trying to lower our corporate tax rate. We moved the factory to Switzerland. Our particular product is a more complicated one, so you can't have an uneducated workforce. But that's a loss that we experience as a result of that. Let me just put this question to you. You think if we lowered our corporate tax rate to 5 or 10%, that there wouldn't be a flood of companies coming over here to open up manufacturing facilities in the United States because of the money they would save on transportation, one, and then all the corporate taxes they'd be paying in their home country, and the advantage they could take up of the American workforce, which is an educated, intelligent workforce?
No, because there are dozens of countries around the world that will give all kinds of tax deferrals to these corporations. There are states that will do it. You've got companies playing them off, one off another. You know, this Boeing played this game recently for their head. They shouldn't be allowed. They do it because they're obviously trying to get the best deal. They shouldn't be allowed to. And if we had a trade policy that said, fine, if you want to make your stuff in Switzerland, that's cool. You can do that. However, when you import it into the United States, you're going to pay a tax on the arrival of that product. So if you want to sell it in the United States, you better make it in the United States, which is the way it used to be. Then you wouldn't have companies that are basically playing one country against the other the way that we have companies in the United States playing one state or one community against the other. I think it's frankly criminal if a company does that.
Tom, if we don't do it, it's a competitive world. Other countries are going to...
Exactly. It's a competitive world because the rules of the game have been changed to allow, to give companies more power than countries. To allow a corporation to say, what's going to be best for us is all we're going to take into consideration. What's best for the people of this country that we're operating in or that we're selling to hell with them, it doesn't matter.
Well,
and that's wrong.
Here's the problem, Tom.
Pardon?
Here's the problem. If you try and change that just in the United States, we now live in a global world. If you try and say, well,
we don't live in a global world now any more than we did back when the British East India Company was sailing around the world.
Yeah, sure, I understand mercantilism and all of that, Tom, but we do live in a global world. Those companies are simply going to move to the most advantageous area. There's not much that you can do about that except...
There is a lot you can do about that. You can say, fine, if you want to move over to Switzerland and manufacture your products there, don't plan on selling them here.
Okay, we'll go...
Become
we'll go
a
back.
Swiss company. And now you're going to have to compete, by the way, with Swiss companies who are very aggressive. I started a corporation in Switzerland in 1986, Vertrauen AG, and I can tell you, first of all, Swiss corporate law is pretty restrictive, and secondly, the Swiss are... I mean, you've got some really seriously competitive people over there.
Well, of course. But what I'm saying is for us to compete on a global economy, and it is a global economy, Tom, we need to encourage corporations to manufacture here.
No, Dan, what you're suggesting, what I'm saying is it shouldn't be a global economy.
So
what
we
I'm
don't
saying
think
is
we
that
be selling, look at Microsoft. How would Microsoft be if we weren't selling Microsoft Windows around the world? That's a benefit to us as Americans. We sell.
I am not suggesting that Microsoft should not be able to sell around the world. What I'm saying is that every country should be able to have trade policies that protect that country and protect the workers in that country. Here's the fundamental question, Dan. Is the economy here to serve the people? Is the economy here, do we allow industry, let's be absolutely honest about this, we allow industrial activity. It doesn't happen in and of itself. If we're going to sponsor it with government by creating laws that the courts and jails and currency and everything else that provides for industrial activity, if we're going to, or any kind of, you know, even intellectual property, to allow that kind of, if we're going to allow that kind of activity, are we doing that for the benefit purely of those with capital? Or are we doing that for the benefit of society? In other words, does the economy work for society, or does society work for the economy? For 200 years, the consensus in Europe and the United States was that the economy works for society. Since the 1980s, that consensus has been changing as a consequence in large part of Milton Friedman's writings and Reagan and Thatcherism. And now, and then Bill Clinton with the WTO and GATT and NAFTA and all this kind of thing. And now it's flipped to where the consensus is, the Thomas Friedman world is flat consensus that, you know, to hell with the people being first, it's the capitalists first. And all of us are here to serve capital. And I don't buy it.
Tom, when you say allow, it's we encourage, we want, not that we allow. We all benefit from a great economy. We all benefit from companies making their products that we enjoy.
Not necessarily. No, there are many of us who don't benefit from economies that are skewed in ways that are not helpful or not useful to the workers. And you're seeing this in the United States. You know, look at the clothing mills and the textile mills in South Carolina that are out of business now because we changed our trade policies. We changed the rules of the game, and you've got people who no longer have jobs.
Tom.
Don't you get it, Dan? It's either you create an economy that works for all of us, or you create an economy that only works for a small number of people, and those are the choices. And Dan has dropped off the line. Oh well, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
I don't want millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
9.5 minutes before the hour. Now, if I recall correctly,
your Rolls Royce, mister.
The federal corporate tax rate, it's been a few years since I sold the last C Corp that I was, you know, it's been a decade, actually. The corporation that we have now is a sub S. And so I'm not quite sure. I don't have it right in front of me. But my recollection is the maximum federal corporate income tax rate in the United States is in the neighborhood of 30%. And that on average, I know on average, corporations in the United States are paying around 8%. In Switzerland, just for our last caller, just here's a heads up for you. And, you know, you can go over and you can check this out on the Swiss government website, for that matter. I'm looking at one from Pete Marwick. In Switzerland, the federal corporate income tax rate is a flat rate of 8.5%. Now, that means that you're going to be paying taxes in Switzerland, 8.5%, that are more than most American corporations are paying, because most American corporations are paying a lot less than 8.5%. On top of that, in Switzerland is divided into cantons, or cantons, like we have states. And they add a corporate tax rate. They are progressive. They go up to 25%, but the average tax rate on corporations billed and paid by the cantons is 22%. So you've got a 22% essentially state income corporate income tax and an 8.5% federal flat income tax in Switzerland. Which is, if I'm doing my math right, you know, 33.5%, which is right smack dab, as far as I can tell, in the neighborhood of what the U.S. corporate tax rate is for the C-Corps. In fact, perhaps even higher. So I think somebody's blowing smoke at you. All right, to our last caller. Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, on the line with us, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, thank you so much. I'm actually in Denver, though I have lots of Washington news for the Democratic walkthrough for the convention.
Okay.
And just an interesting note, new media is demanding better space, better attention in this convention, and we'll see what happens.
What's the convention, Ellen?
This is the Democratic National Convention that will happen in August, but it's the media walkthrough today.
I see. Okay.
The president today, this morning, had a talk, and actually he's giving it this afternoon, I'm sorry, but they released the talking points this morning, and he's basically saying that the majority, meaning the Democrats, were elected on a pledge of fiscal responsibility. He starts complaining. I mean, this is really quite amazing. $22 billion more than they said they would. He said they're acting irresponsibly. Well, at the same time the president does this, the Joint Economic Committee gets out of their statistics, and as you know, that's sort of a bipartisan committee, basically, that it's also joint between the Democrats and the House. And, of course, it's bipartisan, but but it's controlled by the Democrats. And they're now saying that if the Iraq war were to continue, it would be $3.5 trillion if it stays on course. The economic costs per family are $46,400. The actual costs, they're saying, are double the president's request, because you're talking about health care for veterans, all of those kinds of things. And they are saying that instead of having productive investments, that there was borrowing of to finance the Iraq war, and that they are looking at a huge amount in terms of $1.6 trillion between 2002 and 2008 for the Iraq war and Afghanistan. And it could even balloon up to, in terms of if you keep the post-surge troop levels over 10 years, to $4.5 trillion. Now, no wonder Bush is complaining about 22 extra billion for a lot of things like food stamps, et cetera, through some of the HHS initiatives in terms of health care. And he's complaining about, and he vetoed a bill this morning. He vetoed the labor HHS bill.
Right.
And he's complaining about $22 billion, and we're talking about trillions for the Iraq war.
And consider how incompetent the Democrats are at messaging on this. S-CHIP, for example. Who knows what S-CHIP means? Nobody knows what that means. If the Republicans can come up with an act that takes away our rights and call it the Patriot Act, if they can come up with a bill that allows people to cut down forests and call it the Healthy Forest Initiative, if they can come up with a bill that allows polluters to dump more...
And call it Blue Sky.
That's right. Yeah, clear skies. I mean, why can't the Democrats rename the S-CHIP thing as the Save Our Children program, or the Healthy Children, America
because
for America's...
good radio people like you and I to sit there and help them.
And in addition to that, exactly, in addition to that, why don't they say, okay, it's $40,000 per family right now is the cost of the Iraq war, spread into the future. Have you started saving your $40,000 yet to pay for George Bush's war? Or actually, they shouldn't even call it Bush's war, because he's leaving office. Have you saved your $40,000 yet to pay for the Republicans' war, for Joe Lieberman's war, for the war that's continuing? Have you saved your $40,000? Because you're going to have to pay it. I mean, where are the ads? Where is the grandstanding? Where are they holding the giant bill or the giant invoice in front of Congress? I mean,
well,
this is stuff Newt would have done so fast.
Harry Reid got a little bit of spine today, and he said that they were not going to approve this $50 billion supplemental for the president unless he came up with a plan to get the troops out of Iraq. So he's actually
God bless him.
Moving towards a showdown, and this is the first time I've really heard Harry Reid be that tough, and he just did that this morning.
Now, there was an interesting article over in Politico about how it looks like, according to this article, that the main thing that derailed the Democrats from getting us out of Iraq was Congressman Brian Baird coming back from Iraq and saying that he thought the surge was going wonderfully. Any credence to that? I mean, it's getting a lot of press.
We've had several, yeah. I mean, I saw that David Pop is our great political reader and gives a Politico reader and gives us. The problem is they had several people come back. It wasn't just Baird. It was
right.
Other people who came back as well who said, well, it really looks like, you know, there's been some real changes.
Yeah, see, I think they all got George Romney'd. I mean, that's my take on it, is that they all got brainwashed. But anyway, so here we are. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks for the call, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great to have you on. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, as our hour goes on here, welcome back to the third hour of our program. We will be getting back to this topic of what's going on with taxes in Switzerland and the economy and everything else. But first, just to lighten things up a little bit, and, you know, sometimes there's things you know, and sometimes there's things you don't know, and there's sometimes things that you didn't even know that you didn't know.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible? Is it possible, as the Fire Sign Theater would say, that everything you know is wrong? Has virtue been met on the battlefield, routed, defeated, occupied, and re-educated in prison camps? Well, a voice that may be familiar to you if you listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR. Peter Segal is with us. Peter, welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Great to be here with you.
Thank you. And, Peter, you have a new book out from HarperCollins. It's called The Book of Vice, Very Naughty Things and How to Do Them, and how apparently you've done some of them.
Yeah, well, you know, what can I say? I'm not really old enough to have an end-of-life confessional, but I decided to jump the gun and get going on it.
I guess so. In the Book of Vice, you talk about you and your wife going to a swingers club.
I
confess I've never done such a thing. In fact, I think if I proposed it, I'd probably be sleeping outside. What's the deal here?
Well, the deal basically is, I should say, that I was there, as I told anybody who asked me once I arrived, strictly for research purposes. They didn't know that
right.
I was researching a book. Of the ethos of strip clubs, excuse me, swingers clubs. I went to strip clubs, too, to keep them straight in my head. Part of the ethos of swingers clubs is nobody has to do what they don't want to do. You can always say no, and there's no pressure. No pressure at all, in fact. That may be the slogan for the whole lifestyle movement. No pressure. Now, the reason they say no pressure is because they want you to go ahead and do it. That's why they want you there. But they are, you know, they do stick to that. So my wife and I were allowed to wander around and chat with people and not, you know, we were not propositioned, nor did we proposition anybody else once we made it. I mean, by the same token, once we let everybody know that we were there just for research purposes, they got pretty bored with us because they didn't come to help anybody with their research, did they?
Right.
So as I say in the book, it's the first time in a long life of hanging out in various kinds of sexual marketplaces that I was the one who wouldn't put out, but nonetheless it was true.
So what drew you or drove you to examine vice in our culture, you know, from gambling to as you're talking about swinging to sex for money right across the board. What? Why?
Well, basically, it would be a lot more fun than writing about virtue, don't you think?
I mean,
it's a flip answer, but not an untrue one. I mean, you and your show and Air America in general, you probably do some of the same things that we do, which we talk on. When I say we, I mean, wait, don't tell me the NPR show I host.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about serious issues, at least we talk about serious issues, maybe not in a serious way, but issues of politics and current events and so on and so forth. And frankly, when I sat down to write a book, I wanted to get away from that as much as I could. And there's a connection, though, which is that a lot of the people who we talk about in our show, because we are a satire show that makes fun of people, the people we make fun of tend to be made fun of because they've got caught doing something they weren't supposed to be doing.
The Larry Craigs of the world.
I mean, an iconic example, an example that might end up being a verb. Oh, man, he Larry Craig'd, didn't he?
Yeah.
He's not in the book because it happened too late, but it sort of sums up the whole thing. So when I sat down to write a book, I was like, maybe I should just, you know, give up the pretense and the middleman and just go write about these naughty things to begin with. Plus, I am to put it mildly, something of a vanilla fellow. And I was intensely curious about these things that I don't really do and don't understand too well, and thought it would be kind of interesting to go out and figure it all out.
Well, I suspect most people are, and therefore I suspect that your book is doing very well. We're talking with Peter Segal. He is the author of a new book, The Book of Vice, Very Naughty Things and How to Do Them, and also the host of the NPR show, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Peter, give us some of the more interesting things that you encountered in your exploration.
Well, I mean, the things that I did were fairly typical of sort of what you might call the vice industry. You quoted me from the book earlier saying, you know, virtue has been defeated, and one of the reasons is there's so much money. I mean, it's so common if you and your listeners were to go to, say, Las Vegas. I mean, you know, it's pretty much out there in the open. So I did things like I went to the swingers club, I went to a strip club, I went to a number of strip clubs, I should say. In fact, just over the weekend, I got to revisit Mary's Club, the oldest strip club in Portland, and I had a little reunion with my pals there.
In Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon, yeah. Huh. I was just up there. Great. I highly recommend anybody who's the world's nicest strip club.
That's interesting. Well, I live in Portland. I'm in New York. But
Portland's a great town. It's a wonderful town.
I guess I've never heard of Mary's, but I've only lived there 2.5 years. So.
Oh, you got to go to Mary's. As soon as you get home, you got to check it out. Portland, as I'm sure you know, as a native there, has the highest proportion of sex workers to per capita of anywhere in the nation. So
I know they've got a lot of strip clubs. You just drive around, you see them everywhere.
Yeah, well, this is the oldest and, in my view, the best because it's the friendliest.
So you consider a person working in a strip club as a sex worker?
Well, I do. I mean, I think that's what they often call themselves, those who talk in that way. So, sure, I'll be happy to call them a sex worker. And, And, you know, having seen a few of them more than my share, it's not about the choreography. So, yeah.
What about Bill Bennett's, peculiar obsession with gambling? You explored that realm as well.
Well, that to me was a great example, and a number of levels. First of all, it's an example of what I was talking about, the kind of thing we talk about on my radio show, i.e. people who should know better doing things they shouldn't do. But it raises an interesting question, which is why would such, and I will grant him this, a very intelligent, educated man like William Bennett, who's capable of understanding basic math at least as much as I am, and therefore knowing that the stupidest thing to do is to put your money in a slot machine and pull the handle,
right,
why would he then do that?
To the tune of like $1 million or something.
Yeah, I know.
Mind-boggling amount of money.
And you can't simply say, well, he was being dumb, because that doesn't tell you anything. Well, yes, he was being dumb, but that's not, I mean, he must have been telling himself something else. And the reason in my book, I try to answer that question. Why would an otherwise intelligent, capable person who knows the value of a dollar throw away those dollars doing certain things? Why would men who understand exactly what will and won't happen in a strip club, who understand exactly why that woman is showing her naughty bits to you and acting like she likes you, men who understand exactly why that woman is doing it, namely because you're handing her $20 bills every 10 minutes, why would they think it's anything other than it is? How could they enjoy it as anything other than it is?
Right.
These are the questions that I was genuinely curious about and tried to go explore.
So what's your conclusion?
Well, let's see, how much time do we have?
we have about 2 minutes.
I got about 2 minutes. Basically, they're just stupid.
Just
no,
stupid.
No, I don't.
No, I mean, yeah, for some people, it's recreation. My mother, for example, my dad, there's an Indian casino up, you know, and they live in Michigan, or before my dad died, used to go up and, you know, she'd do nickel slots in this thing.
Yeah.
And dad calculated it and it said, you know, it costs less than going to movies.
Exactly.
And so, you know, with nickel slots. But that's not what Bill Bennett was doing.
No, he was spending a lot more money than he would have cost going to... He was spending as much money he would have produced his own movie for the money that he was spending. Well, basically, I mean, not to get bogged down into the details of my various arguments, but I think a lot of it has to do with the rebellion inherent in it. I think that, you know, for example, gambling, part of the appeal is that you're doing something irrational. And I think that's particularly true for someone like William Bennett, who by virtue of his own labors has created a certain image for himself of virtue, of morality. He, did, after all, wrote the book on virtue. And he probably, on some level, really enjoyed doing something he wasn't supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of it. There's a rebellion. And one of the things...
And we all do at some level in various
times. Absolutely. One of the things you're rebelling against is reason and good sense.
Yeah.
When it comes to strip clubs, slightly more complicated. But, I mean, let me put it this way. I always wondered what the point of a strip club would be when you are taking something that is normally sort of an intensely human interaction, i.e. the sexual interaction, and making it completely depersonalizing it, completely taking away any actual...
Well, there is a component of sex that is not personal, that is purely biological. I mean,
right.
It's just that we're wired to reproduce.
Right. Well, absolutely we are. But if you go to a strip club and you hang out, and there's a lot going on more than just sexual display. There's when a woman... A good one, anyway, a professional dancer, when she's interacting with a customer and what they call a lap dance or a private dance, she's not just acting sexually excited. She's acting like she really likes him.
She's acting affectionate.
Look at her face. I did this a fair bit. You know, they're whispering things in their customer's ear. They're flirting. They're laughing, you know. And they're doing this because they're getting paid $20 every 10 minutes or so.
Right.
And my question was, how could a man possibly enjoy this? Here's this beautiful woman pretending she likes me because I'm giving her money. How could I in any way derive any pleasure from this? And the answer is...
Well, did you?
I didn't, because I didn't actually. What I did was, this was really stupid, is I went into these clubs and I tried to pay the woman to talk to me.
Oh my.
Which is among the stupidest things you could do, because they'll say anything you want, you know what I mean? It's perhaps the least accurate way of conducting an interview ever invented.
Well, you've got to write a sequel to the Book of Vice, Very Naughty Things and How to Do Them, and I went off and did them the right way rather than the wrong way. Peter Sagal, he is the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, his new book, The Book of Vice, Very Naughty Things and How to Do Them. Peter, thanks for dropping by.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Home on the range. Oh, give me a home where no liberals roam.
same way.
Oh, George, you got to stop singing these songs.
Where each house has a gun, a big caliber one. And strangers are told, make my day. Home, home on the range, where the beer and the cantaloupe lay. Where seldom is heard a three-syllable word, or so that it's one I can say.
There you go. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Charlene Espinosa is in the studio with me. You've heard Charlene from time to time as a correspondent for Talk Radio News. And about a year ago, I think it was. First of all, welcome, Charlene.
Thank you.
I'm so great to have you with us. You're also a pilot with United Airlines. In fact, when I was flying out here, you were two seats behind me.
That's right. Instead of two seats in front of me.
Right, yeah. You were deadheading home or whatever they
That's
call
right.
it, you know, coming home and in your pilot's uniform. And we shared the train into the city that night. And was it Saturday night? I guess it was. Yeah, it was great to see you. And I wanted to find out what was up. You and Ellen and others have been working down in Mississippi. You wrote this brilliant book, Through the Eye of the Storm, and it's out there. It's in print. And throughtheeyeofthestorm.com is the website. And at that website, you can get information not just about the book, but also about this extraordinary nonprofit work that you and Ellen and others have put together down in Mississippi. Tell us about this.
Thank you. Well, Tom, just like yourself, we were part of the recovery and relief efforts of Katrina, not really so much as journalists, but as Americans. And we went down and basically found this little community to deliver supplies to in Pass Christian, Mississippi. And they shared with us a vision that they had, Rosemary Williams, to build an education center and a housing development before Katrina. Right. And to me, I sort of felt like we were in the right place at the right time. If any good could come out of Katrina, maybe resources would be brought to that area. And I was so inspired by this community that I wrote Through the Eye of the Storm, which basically weaves my experiences in Iraq as a journalist, as well as in the military flying U-2s, with this relief effort in this community. And so far, we've raised the building cost for the center, $1.6 million, and a public swimming pool, the first since desegregation in that area. And now we are raising operating costs for the programs, and we're finally moving into the housing piece. So it's been the challenge of a lifetime, but very humbling and very rewarding.
Right. From spy planes at what, 50,000 feet?
Above 70,000
feet. Above 70,000 feet to being absolutely on the ground, on your feet, working with people face-to-face. We're talking with Charlene Espinosa, her book, Through the Eye of the Storm. It's really a remarkable book. I encourage you to pick up a copy and read it. And it tells the story of the initial work that you guys put together, and now you're telling us where it's at now. And if people want to participate in this or contribute to it or just learn more about it, Through the Eye of the Storm, just like it sounds, .com will get you there. Charlene, also, you work with Talk Radio News Service as well as flying airplanes for United and all kinds of cool things. You were at the UN today?
Yes, I was. I was at a press briefing at the UN with the UN High Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner for Refugees, and her name is Erica Feller, and she briefed us primarily on the refugee situation, externally displaced outside of Iraq. And the interesting thing for me, Tom, is that I really viewed the Katrina situation as internally displaced persons.
Right.
And I've seen how not having a home, not having a community, particularly when you've got just a mass wipeout of an entire region, whether it's New Orleans or Gulf Coast of Mississippi, it spawns all these other problems with crime and child abuse and alcoholism and these kind of things. And right. And people, when they have less to lose, they tend to exercise sort of deviant behaviors, as we were saying.
Yeah.
And
our last segment.
Yes, exactly. Another variation on that. And so really what we believe is that this community center and housing is critical to growth. And the question that I actually asked the commissioner was, what about internally displaced Iraqis? Let's say hypothetically that we were to invest in housing in Iraq and try to stabilize and provide jobs.
Like 2 million internally.
yes,
displaced.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yeah. And 1.4 outside. Well, 1.4 in Syria.
Yeah.
more than that outside. And she said something that was very disturbing. She said, you know, that's an interesting question, but these people are targeted refugees. They're not just economically displaced, but they essentially have a target on their back.
They're the victims of ethnic cleansing.
Exactly. So we don't know if, you know, if we moved or they moved to another neighborhood, if that would work. Of course, you know, we're starting in Mississippi to see if this will work. And my ultimate dream, as I shared with you, would be to build houses in communities in Iraq, because as you mentioned, flying above 70,000 feet and being an Iraqi embedded journalist, I feel a sense of responsibility to them.
You've got it. This is one world, we're one people, we're one human race.
Right.
So well said. Charlene Espinoza, her book, Through the Eye of the Storm. The website, ThroughTheEyeOfTheStorm.com. Check it out. It's you'll be very glad you did. 27 minutes past the hour. Thanks so much, Charlene.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com for our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our blog. Drop in, say hi, visit. By the way, tonight I will be at the Strand Bookstore here in Manhattan signing books at 7 o'clock. Richard Belzer will be introducing me, and this is for Cracking the Code. I guess Book TV is going to be there, C-SPAN. Tomorrow afternoon at 5:30 at Demos, I will be speaking, and Mark Green will be there introducing me, and it'll be great to see Mark again. He's the head honcho here. And on Friday, I will be in San Francisco. We'll be doing our show live from Green 960 AM in San Francisco, and then that afternoon at 3:30, I'll be at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City. You can get more information about that. You have to have tickets to get into that. Green960.com is the website. And then on Saturday, November 17th, I'll be at the Pilgrim's Way Bookstore in Carmel, California, and there we will be doing two book signings there, because one has already sold out. They're booking for the second, and that's in conjunction with KRXA, our affiliate in that neck of the woods. And then coming down the road at the end of November, November 29th, I'll be in Los Angeles at 7:30 on the 29th at the Barnes & Noble 3rd Street Promenade. So, anyway, that's what's up. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Peter in Midland, Michigan. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Related to the guy, your discussion about taxes and stuff like that, you know, if taxes were the only criteria for corporate investment, the most prosperous states in the nation would be states like Louisiana and Mississippi, not California, Oregon, and Massachusetts.
Right, and the most prosperous countries in the world would be Namibia.
Exactly, or Malawi, right. And, you know, we in Michigan, we're seeing this kind of thing and watching our auto industry relocate right across the river to Ontario, where they get the proximity to markets that they like for this location, but they also get a national health care system, which removes a tremendous burden from them, and they get a really good educational system, too. So these are all very critical areas that governments have a lot to do with, that taxes have a lot to do with, that are absolutely vital for corporate competitiveness.
Right. That's the bottom line is, if you don't have the infrastructure, if you don't have the physical infrastructure, and if you don't have the social and political and economic infrastructure on which business does business, you know, this is the substrate on which business exists. It's the soil in which business grows. If you don't have that, business can't exist. And that substrate, that soil, that basis on which business exists, the cultural, physical, economic, political, judicial, all of that is the consequence of government and is paid for with taxes.
Exactly.
So,
and if I can just throw one more thing in the mix, Tom, you know, we're in the United States, we're on the verge of losing our technological leadership because under this administration we have refused to take leadership on the issue of energy and climate and what we're going to have to do to exist as a civilization in a global climate change world.
Right.
And this is all going to be taken away from us by the Europeans, by the Chinese, by the Japanese, and that process is ongoing.
Right, which gets us right back to the whole issue of the commons. I mean, you
of
know,
course.
It's yeah. Well said. Dan, Peter, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Mike in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Mike, I got something wrong?
That's a first-time caller to your national program. Yeah, I was really disappointed to hear your paraphrase of Brian Baird during your segment with Ellen Ratner in the previous hour. Brian never said anything remotely resembling that everything was going wonderfully.
Well, that the surge was working, actually, was what, and that we had to give it more time. That's my recollection. I mean, I was on the air with him when he said it.
What he said was, yes, there was there were signs of progress. It had less to do with the so-called surge than it did with the coalescence of the Sunni and Shia sheikhs in Al-Anbar. It had a lot more to do with that. But he never said things were going wonderfully. He spent an entire hour with Carl Wilson talking about his position after he'd come back from Iraq. I suggest you listen to the audio again.
I was not participating in that, but I was in the studio when that happened. You're right. And what I was talking about is this article over on the Politico, and you know, rightly or wrongly, they're calling out Brian on this, and I have great respect for Brian, and I've made that very clear on the local show on KPOJ because he's a regular guest on our show, and he's been on this national show at least two or three times over the years. But Jim Vandehei and John Harris over at Politico, which is like this, you know, the website that all the insiders read, talk about how the Democrats feel like they've kind of blown their opportunity to do this. And here's where it goes. House Minority Whip Roy Blunt told us last week his biggest fear early on, he's a Republican from Missouri, was that Democrats would seek compromise solutions with moderate Republicans on the war and other issues. So that's what the Republicans were afraid of, was that the Democrats would join up with the moderate Republicans and they'd basically stop the war. Blunt suggested the strategy probably would have worked. But once Congressman Brian Baird, Democrat of Washington, a staunch war opponent, returned from a visit to Iraq and applauded the surge, any chance of a compromise clampdown ended. Repeated predictions that GOP support was on the verge of collapsing never materialized, and Republican support for the war is now probably stronger than when the Democrats took power.
And that, too, is a mischaracterization. He never applauded the surge any more than when John Soltz came to town, crashed our town hall with Brian, and said that he was voting with Bush. He never said that. He never said, like MoveOn said, that Barrett has changed his stance to we'll stay there as long as it takes. He never said any of those things. And I think part of the, and this is part of the problem with the whole debate around the occupation of Iraq right now, is that everybody has drawn, you know, they've dug in their heels in this position, whether because it was wrong to go in, we should get out immediately, and that's where...
Well, I'd say a large part of the problem, Mike, is that everybody, particularly in the mainstream media, but, you know, I'll cop to this too, everybody is looking for the soundbite. Are you for the occupation? Are you against the occupation? Do you want to get out now? Do you want to get out later? And Brian's position is very nuanced. And it's very difficult for most people to even understand a nuanced position, much less for the media to communicate it.
Agreed. And this is part of the frustration I have just listening to any radio about this right now. The debate we need to be having is what happens if we leave right now. And I don't think anybody's really having that conversation other than my congressman. I think he's the only one who's earnestly asking that question, what happens if we leave right now. And that's why he spent his last trip out there, you know, visiting all these foreign countries. And he took his own tour of Iraq. He didn't take the Pentagon canned tour and sit through a bunch of their PowerPoints that Schakowsky did. It wasn't the same experience.
Yeah. Okay, well said, Mike, and your defense of Brian Baird is noted. Thank you very much for the call. Robert in Bergen County, New Jersey. Hey, Robert.
Hi. I noticed that you were on something of Milton Friedman tear earlier.
Yeah.
And I wanted to share something with you that I read recently. I'm a Rutgers College grad, and apparently Milton Friedman was as well, class of 32.
Oh, interesting.
And when he
just
passed,
just for our listeners, by the way, Milton Friedman is the economist who held court at the they refer to it as the Chicago School is the University of Chicago, right? Or the University of Illinois?
Correct. He sums it up here. I think he gives a good synopsis. A student, a PhD student who was present when Milton Friedman visited Rutgers College after he had successfully launched his book Capitalism and Freedom in 1962, he gave a public speech at Rutgers to a full auditorium. Dr. Friedman gave a precis on his book in the form of an attack on the Great Society. The theme that he pressed, both then and now, was that government intervention always exacerbates social challenges rather than solving them.
Right.
He gives on to give a couple of examples. And then he writes, after 45 minutes, he called for questions. Many hands rose, and Friedman called on a young man who asked a question that was probably on the minds of many. Quote, if the market works so effectively without intervention, then why do economic and social problems become so severe that there are political pressures for government to address them? Unquote. The crowd buzzed with approval, and the crowd buzzed with approval of the question and awaited Friedman's response. Friedman stood quietly with a small smile until there was a perfect silence and pointed to the young man. He said, I want you to look at this young man. He has just asked me why we do not live in nirvana. The audience laughed nervously at Friedman's cynical challenge and quickly forgot the initial question.
Hmm.
As the laughter subsided, Friedman asked, are there other questions? There were none.
Wow.
It seems to me that really sums up, for those who would aspire to Friedman's view, it's necessary condition. It's a cynical viewpoint.
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure that Milton Friedman was cynical. I mean, I've read some of his works. I don't pretend to be a scholar of Milton Friedman, but I'm certainly familiar with his works and his positions. And I would say he was a utopianist. You know, he and the libertarians who have latched onto him and follow on, and the conservatives for that matter, even the extent to which Tom Friedman is following Milton Friedman's stuff. In his whole world, his flat theory, you know, basically leave it all to the big corporations. They're utopianists. They believe, you know, if only, you know, they always start out, if only everybody would. And, you know, God save us from the utopianists. I mean, the Trotsky, you know, was a utopianist. I mean, it's just, I was going to say Stalin, but I don't think he really was. I think he was just a good old-fashioned dictator. But spot on, Robert. It's that's how bad it gets. And you know, Milton Friedman really was the intellectual engine behind what eventually became, in a large part, Reaganomics, which was the rationale. I mean, there were others, but which became the rationale for deconstructing the New Deal and thus deconstructing the American middle class. And here we are, 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Oh, please, Mr. President, I voted for you. Not just one time either, I think it was two. I like the way you said that you would throw away the key. But there's been some kind of error that came to get me.
Uh-oh.
I need to call a lawyer to straighten this out. No one in here knows or cares what I'm talking about. When we threw out that habeas corpus and those trials you see, wasn't that for the bad guys, not the good guys like me?
Jim Tara's in trouble.
Guard, don't beat me again. Can't you see in other circumstances we could? Won't you let me call my lawyer? I can call him at home. I ain't one of the bad guys. I'm Rodney Malone.
Those terrorists
and protesters, they all hate the U.S. And they should be gotten rid of. I agree that would be best. But I thought there was some way that you would surely have known. I ain't one of the bad guys, I'm Rodney Malone.
Indeed. You can check that out over at BlueCanyonProductions.com. Jim's does some great work. 51 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Sally in Seattle. Hey, Sally, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I didn't read the book that you wrote, Cracking the Code, is it called?
Yeah, just came out, actually. So
did you ever come up with the concept that more than likely the Republicans are hiring a top crack advertising agency to fill in all the words for everything they have to say about
race. There's no doubt about it. I mean, the head guy, I mean, the brain trust, the one-man brain trust for the thing has been Frank Luntz for the past 20 years. He has his own book out about framing language and arguments.
These people that specialize in that, they hire psychologists and people that know human reaction.
Yep.
And why in heaven's name aren't the Democrats doing the same thing?
Yeah. Yeah, good question, Sally. I don't have the answer, but good question. Thank you very much. Joe in Butler, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Tom. Tom, I understand your insistence on raising the taxes. It's not fair in a lot of ways, but I never hear you attack Congress's ability to overspend. And we would not be in the hot water we're in financially if they reined in their free spending, their drunken sailor spending habits.
Oh, yeah? What's, for example?
I'll give you one example right off the bat. All the money that we send into the Middle East to support all these different governments, Egypt and Israel to begin with, between those two, it's estimated since 1960-something, it's over $1 trillion.
Yeah, but on a per-year basis, I mean, I think that our aid to Egypt and Israel is somewhere in the neighborhood of, what, around $15 or $16 billion, maybe $20 billion at the most?
Tom, whether it's a penny or it's $16 billion or whatever.
Joe, here's an argument that's made for that, and that is that they serve as stabilizers for the region that is providing our addiction to oil. If you don't want to be sending money into the Middle East, particularly to our allies in the Middle East, then you better first be talking about, let's slap a $10 or $15 a gallon tax on gasoline to discourage consumption in the United States, the way the Europeans slapped a $4 tax on gasoline back over 30 years ago, and they're now consuming one-seventh as much gasoline per capita as we are.
Then let's do that, Tom. Let's slap that on. The quicker we do it...
But see, I'd say that's not drunken sailor spending on the part of Congress. That's Congress responding to the political realities and the political demands of this nation right at the moment, and not doing it in the very best way. If the policies that Jimmy Carter had started in the late 70s of making this nation energy independent had been followed, then I think outside of the absolutely understandable and normal realm of, you know, we help our allies around the world, and they help us, by the way, as well, that much of foreign aid and foreign wars. I mean, here's the big one. Consider this: we're spending $2 billion a week to wage a war in Iraq. You want drunken sailor spending? Look at the Republicans. This war in Iraq. This is the Congressional Budget Report. Christy Harvey, tip of the hat to her over at the Center for American Progress, just sent me this summary. This new CBO report just came out. $2.4 trillion. Is the so far estimated cost of this thing. This is what you could do. That's $20,200 per average family of four. Here's 10 things you could do with that $20,000. You could send your kids to a public college for 3 years. You could feed your family for 2 years. You could heat your home for 20 years. You could buy a Prius. You could buy your annual health care premium for a year and a half.
I agree.
I mean, you know, it's nuts. It's nuts.
Tom, I agree 100%, and it was the Republicans and Democrats both who put us in this jam.
Yeah. Okay.
And I have one more question for you. You talk about our allies. What country is our ally?
Well, that's an interesting question. There are a number of reasons why we would want to reach out to other countries and help them economically. If we're helping them develop and hoping that they become democracies, if they're in regions that are strategically of interest to us, I mean, historically we've had enemies out there. I mean, you know, the Soviet Union, the major one. Although I think that a lot of that enemy-ness was hyped up in the 1970s by Rumsfeld and the Committee for Present Danger, Rumsfeld and Cheney, actually, who were heading up that thing, the Committee for Present Danger, and, you know, who, after in 72, when Nixon said, we no longer need to live in fear, you know, he came back with detente, and they said, oh, no, these guys are... But there are strategic, there are military interests, but most of it, frankly, I think has to do with resources, and that's, again, comes back to, you know... At a certain level, and I'm not arguing for you know, another Monroe Doctrine, but at a certain level, I think that we really need to be looking at becoming self-sufficient, or as self-sufficient as we can. We don't even make, you know, clothes in the United States anymore, Joe. We can't feed ourselves. Or actually, probably that's about the last thing left that we could do is feed ourselves. But but a lot of our food is not coming from the United States. Many of the things that we eat, and we don't make our clothing in this country. We can't make a missile right now without parts from China, a company that's threatened to bomb us. I mean, how bizarre is that? So, yeah, I agree with your call for a fundamental realignment of our priorities. And I think that, you know, one of our priorities should be let's pay our bills. Anyhow, don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. I'll be at the Strand tonight at 7 o'clock. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.